You might have thought it would never happen, but Switchcast is endorsing a transport company. Whether you're moving a rare collectible, a high-end sports car, or your personal luxury vehicle, Shaughnessy Overland Express delivers with precision, privacy, and respect. This isn't just transport, it's white glove care from pickup to delivery. For over 14 years, they've earned the trust of collectors, enthusiasts, dealers, and owners by offering unmatched service and personalized attention. You'll work directly with their experienced in-house team, ensuring a smooth and private experience without middlemen or surprises. Every shipment is protected with up to $3 million in cargo insurance, offering peace of mind for even the most valuable and rare vehicles on the road. In addition to their enclosed fleet, they've also established a trusted auto transport brokerage service, giving you access to a nationwide network of vetted open and enclosed carriers. Whether you need transport on a route they don't currently operate or their carriers are at full capacity when your schedule demands, they'll still get it done without compromising the Shaughnessy standard of excellence. Same professionalism, same personal touch, expanded flexibility. We are proud at Switchcast to endorse Shaughnessy Overland Express as the official transporter of Switchcast. Visit soexinc.com and tell them Switchcast sent you. Welcome to Switchcast Season 6. I'm your host, Doug Tabbitt, here with my co-host, Tyler Sanders, and Ethan Huffnagel, the international executive producer, and recently married. He's been married for at least 3 months now, I think.
2 months.
Look at this man showing off his wedding band like it's nothing.
It is 2 months on November 12th was 2 months for us.
Excellent.
Yeah, thank you, Doug.
Excellent. Switchcast is the automotive podcast that's not just for car people. In fact, it's almost better if you're not a car person, because then you won't catch me in my sins.
Yeah, you don't errors. Spend all of the don't say what sins, my goodness. You'll spend less time worrying about whether we're correct or not, and more time just enjoying our fun banter and thinking we're hilarious.
If you do enjoy it, please help us out with the algorithms. Like, subscribe, share, review on whatever platform you're watching or listening to this wonderful show. And if you want more of it, more of the morons, right? There's a thing there. Yeah. Sign up for Patreon, patreon.com/switchcast for exclusive bonus content behind the scenes, and enjoy it with us live as well. You get to see all of our foibles that happen, you know, in between the takes that we cut, you know, pre-editing. Yeah.
I know.
There's
the only
so
thing
much of that, right? A lot left on the cutting room floor with Switchcast.
You know, you'd be surprised.
I mean, Ethan and I were rolling in here for a good couple of minutes.
I'll let you in on something here, viewers and Doug listeners. And Tyler, I guess, and listeners alike. The video versions of the podcast are not always the same as the audio segments.
Mm-hmm.
So you want the best of both worlds there. So make sure you follow Switchcast on all platforms.
Yes.
Well, and honestly, there's not much that has changed with the in-between segment stuff. I just make sure I talk into a microphone more. Typically, I'd like lean back and pop on my phone. I still pop on my phone and chat, but I'm talking into a mic. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we have fun. Let's see. Warm-up lap. Because you should always take a warm-up lap on track and in life.
Yeah.
What's fueling this podcast, Tyler?
Some delicious gin and tonics, I'm assuming made either by
myself.
By you. The Mr. Doug Tabbitt over here. Delicious. Botanist gin, fantastic.
From Isla. Yeah, wonderful. Tyler, somebody came into our showroom the other day. For those of you who don't know, Tyler bought a 996 GT3 and he traded in his dark teal metallic over graphite gray full leather. Was it a full leather?
Oh, yeah.
996.
So
Tyler even trusts a dealership enough to pay a dock fee and get ripped off on a trade-in. He left money on the table for us
now. That's fine. You got to make it. You got to buy a $4 bill and sell it for $5 or whatever you like to say.
But it was easy, and I have to laugh. So the buyer who bought your dark teal metallic car is like you.
I love
somewhere else.
It's kind of crazy. So
same
you
level of anxiousness, of excitement, of the whole thing. Like I'm just like
really
Tyler. This car went to another Tyler.
I'm so happy. You had I put on the Switch Cars Instagram story the post that the new owner made about it, and they seemed just, they wrote more than I did about my GT3.
Which is saying a lot.
And it, I'm so happy. That is exactly the type of person I wanted that car to go to, is somebody that will love it and cherish it. And
it's like just enjoy automotive toasts that we write on social media when we buy a car.
Yeah. And I mean, I did the same thing. I can't knock him. It was a good post. And I just love that. I also love that that was his first Porsche, because that was my first Porsche. And it was like, oh my God, I'm achieving something. Like, this is like, I've, on some level, I've like made a goal in life, and I love this so much. So I love it.
In 5 years, you should try to sell him your white GT3. But anyway, when your car was in our showroom, somebody was in our showroom, just like wandering around, walked over to your car. And the first thing out of their mouth, unprovoked, just walked up to it and they said, boy, someone got the wrong interior color for this car.
No.
Then he follows it up with, you could have had black, tan, anything else, but they chose gray.
Because it looks good.
I nearly spit out my milk and I wasn't even drinking milk.
Holy crap.
I almost asked him to just be like, can you just start that? Can you do that again so I can record it? Because that was so good.
Oh, man. Brutal.
Oh, man.
That's right. It was gorgeous.
Nobody likes traffic cameras, the traffic speed cameras or red light cameras, but especially traffic speed cameras. My wife got one. I told her not to do anything about it, which she did not want to do, but I think she finally caved. She was going to try to narc me and, like, turn me in.
So honest.
Yeah, right, because I was allegedly driving. But Painesville man has challenged the Willoughby Hills, Ohio traffic camera program, and he's actually trying to turn this into a class action lawsuit. Martin Spehar, this is courtesy of Cleveland.com, came up with some legal arguments that says that there are systemic violations of Ohio traffic camera laws, that Willoughby Hills failed to follow multiple state requirements, including obtaining ODOT permission for freeway enforcement, posting proper warning signs at municipal boundaries, et cetera, et cetera. One of the things that he brought up, now he is representing himself, which is interesting for somebody who wants to turn something into a class action suit. I'm not saying he's a sovereign citizen, but it's a common practice of sovereign citizens to represent themselves in court. Claims that the city didn't produce a valid certificate of proper operation or calibration records for the handheld devices. But one of the things he did come up with, he said, or no, this article says that the Institute for Justice, which is a national civil liberties law firm, warned the city of Willoughby Hills that drivers were required to pay a $25 fee before they could contest a citation, a policy that the Institute for Justice called unconstitutional and a violation of due process protections. So the municipal court did pause the fee after they got the letter, which makes sense, right? You have to pay money in order to have due process. No.
Yeah.
No, you don't have to pay a fee. So there have been a number of legal challenges in different cities. Some people have won them. Some people have not. But my wife, the legal research assistant for this podcast, looked the guy up. And apparently he's had some other somewhat dubious legal claims in court as well, trying to go after the city, something to do with chickens or something like that. But I was greatly encouraged by the initial article, and then she burst my bubble by saying, like, I don't think this is the guy that's gonna, you know, put an end to the Willoughby Hills traffic camera enforcement system. So regardless, we've not heard from them about a vehicle which happens to be registered to us allegedly speeding. We haven't heard any more about that, which is what I said. That's what I said.
I don't imagine you will.
Not gonna do anything. We like talking about auctions here.
Yes.
A couple to talk about this week. One of them, Bring a Trailer, has a Challenge Stradale style 2000 Ferrari 360 Modena.
Okay. What makes it style? It looks like some seats. It looks like a rear grille.
A lot of things, actually.
Some wheels, the interior. Ooh, okay.
Do you remember when we did an episode about the Challenge Stradale tribute on SBX cars that only had like, I think the only actual Challenge Stradale part was the transmission control unit and like one other thing.
It was like the mirrors or something.
Yes. No, but they weren't even mirrors. He did aftermarket mirrors because the factory ones were so expensive. Yes.
Okay.
So it was like, it didn't have the body kit. It had 18 inch wheels instead of 19s. It didn't have ceramic brakes. It had the wrong seats. Like it was nothing like a tribute. Well, this one actually has carbon ceramic brakes, 19 inch Challenge Stradale wheels, Challenge Stradale ECU and TCU, Challenge Stradale bodywork, windows, the carbon engine panels, the side skirts, the rear deck lid, like all the nuanced stuff on a Challenge Stradale this has. And they're still only calling it a Challenge Stradale style Modena, whereas SBX called a tribute that was nothing like a tribute. The only thing I wish they had done is done this on a manual car. If it was a manual car, I'd be all over this.
Yeah, this is amazing.
Because to manual swap a Challenge Stradale is expensive, and Stradales have gotten so crazily expensive that it's just a big deal. So yeah, if this was manual car that was a Stradale tribute, I think I'd be bidding on it. But it's ending in a day. It's already at 140K, which I don't remember. I didn't go back through my notes, but the quote-unquote tribute on SBX cars did not do particularly well. I think it high bid to like, what, 70 or 80 grand?
Yeah, it did not. Yeah, it did not end up very well. Wow, this looks great.
It's amazing.
I do wish they didn't put the Challenge Stradale badge on the rear grille, though, I gotta say. It feels like an up badge that I'm not a fan of. Because it's not real.
Although it is such a roof badge on my fake roof, Tyler.
You do, and it's it's fine. I think the thing is, though, in what makes it okay, other than the fact that we're friends, is that you don't try you don't try to pass it off as a roof.
Oh, I denied instantly.
Yeah,
I was
you're
dropping
like, nah,
Blaze off at school the other day, and the cop on duty was like, "Oh, you have the roof, right?" I was like, "No, it's a fake."
Yeah, like, and I think, and now I guess, I don't know about this owner. Maybe the owner's the same way. They're like, now it's a fake, now it's a tribute, whatever. And in that case, I'm more okay. I'm sitting here judging without the context of knowing how they carry themselves with their car. But I think, yeah, that makes it better.
I don't know. It's like putting GT350 on a GT350 clone that's a base Mustang. Like, it's still a real Mustang. I think I'm okay with that. But it depends. I don't know.
I feel like you're inviting the, is it real? And I feel like more people are going to ask you, is it real with a Mustang GT350 than with a roof or even this, truthfully. You're going to get the factory five level, like Cobra of, oh my God, is it real? And you have to say no every time to everybody. That'd be depressing.
But then you explain why it's cool. I don't know.
I'd get so tired of that after like the 10th time of somebody at a gas station rocking up and saying, oh my God.
Speaking of Ferrari six speeds, this is depressing. Another auction I want to highlight is a 98 Ferrari 355 GTS six speed conversion that is going for cray cray money.
Oh, this spec though, Doug. Holy moly.
It's in blue Tour de France with burgundy interior.
And it's in sport seats.
It has, the carbon Kevlar racing seats, which are crazy rare on 355s, especially in the U.S. This is going to lead, we have an interesting full segment coming up about the value return on stick shift conversions. I think this car will be an outlier because of the spec. But we are going to discuss how worth it or not worth it it's going to be to convert manuals.
I mean, they could not have made many of these in this blue with burgundy interior.
I'm sure it's the only one.
Like
racing
seats. Oh my gosh, this is gorgeous.
It is one of one. Interestingly enough, our friends, quote unquote, over at Cario Motor Cars upped the bidding quite a bit. To 150 grand. The bidding's now 166. This thing could go for the moon, which is crazy for conversion, but whatever. Anyway, when Cario Motor Cars was winning it, based on previous experience that we've discussed on this podcast, my thought slash comment, which did not get approved on Bring a Trailer, was coming soon to Cario Motor Cars, factory six-speed manual Ferrari 355.
Nice.
I'm not saying they would do that. I'm saying they have done that.
Yeah.
And even when called out on it, they said, no, that's a different car. Those aren't pictures of our car. That's an E-Gear. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's, I don't know. I wish this car only would go for like 100K because it wasn't a real six-speed, but that's my pipe dreams. Soul and Spine wants everyone to have a higher quality of life. They specialize in non-surgical options for those who have been told that they need injections or surgery. They offer state-of-the-art techniques that help over 90% of patients become pain-free in just weeks. Starting with thorough medical history and comprehensive examination, you'll work one-on-one with Dr. Hoover to meet all your treatment goals. Their mission is to unleash your body's own healing potential to avoid drugs and surgery. Visit solonspine.com to learn more, located in Solon, Ohio. We've talked a lot about different types of auctions, but we haven't covered estate auctions. Estate auctions tend to be, at least what people think they are, is like this hidden gem of I'm going to score a deal on a car because, well, there aren't car people there. It's not on Barrett Jackson. It's not RM Sotheby's. It's not on Bring a Trailer. It's this, you know, small audience, and most of them are there for, you know, the wooden armoires or, you know,
ooh, good word,
hand knit Vietnamese rugs.
Well, like, wouldn't you, I guess, is that not the case? Like, the market is infinitely smaller than something posted on the internet for 7 days.
Is it, though?
I mean, and I guess it depends on how.
Because, so I have a few anecdotes as data points. The reason this topic came up is because I'm searching for a BMW Z8 for our Buy Our Dream Car Challenge.
Are you getting
I've
nervous
talked
yet?
About buying a Z8 for years and years and years and never have done it, and I'm still talking about it. We've had this challenge for 3 years now, and I haven't pulled the trigger, but I was $3,500 away from buying one this week, and it was at an estate auction. My friend Berkeley sent it to me, and he's like, hey, maybe this will go for a deal. And I said, probably not, because it's an estate auction. Based on my experience, there's this interesting phenomenon that happens whereby people think that they're getting a deal. And because of that assumption, stuff goes for crazy money because they don't pay attention to the actual number.
So, is there also a chance that they don't know what the real number is?
Yes, also. Maybe there's just people there that are just like, oh, it's an estate auction. I bought a car at an estate auction.
Yeah.
But I learned this when I first got into the car business. I would go to the wholesale auctions. And it was, I think, Odessa, Cleveland. It was a, you know, off-brand Mannheim.
Yeah.
And they had a repo lane there. And the repo lane was open to the public.
Oh.
Is
it still
now? Or, I don't know. Or like a dealer could bring people there. So the guy who was training me taught me, like, you never bid on anything there because you've got all these people that come in because it's open to the public. It's like the biggest scam there is people go, well, I'm buying a car that's repossessed. I'm buying it at a repo auction. Obviously, I'm getting it way below value. But they don't actually know the value. So they bid it up like crazy. It's kind of like some foreclosure auctions. People don't do their homework. They bought a real estate course for $10,000 online. Well, go buy foreclosures and flip them. You'll make money automatically. Not if everybody else that has no clue what they're doing bids it to the moon. So we would never even go to the repo lane because it's just like stuff would sell for over retail. So it's like people were scamming themselves.
God.
So,
well, and you also get kind of caught up in the whole thing. And you're like, well, I don't want to have it. One more, that's fine. One more, that's fine.
It's got to be a deal. It's at a repo auction. Ugh. Same thing with estate auctions. I've seen this hold true a number of times there was a local auction, I think last year, that had a bunch of Porsches, and they were super low mile, but they were Tiptronics, like a Tiptronic Turbo Cabriolet. And I looked at them. I was like, yeah, whatever. Don't care. They're tips. And I looked at the final values, and I'm like, that's like, they went for like 140K for a turbo cab tip. I was like, whoa, what? And it was a good spec and low miles, but I'm just like, that's crazy. And then Kiko Auctions, who was also running the auction for the pit race.
Yes.
Junk.
Yeah, I'll say, if you want a bathroom, you can buy it, but you got to disassemble it.
Yes, so. Or a half a gravel bin.
Yes, there's like eight barrels half full of gravel.
Yes.
Buy responsible for loading.
One of the things that Kiko Auctions sold was a Porsche 964 Carrera 4 wide body in 94. They only made it one year. There's only a few hundred of them. It was midnight blue, and it only had 700 miles.
Well, that had to, how many of those are in midnight blue? That had to be insane.
Very rare, probably the lowest mileage one out there. But there was no service history. There's no verification of the miles. Nobody knew if the odometer worked. Nope, they didn't post any paint meters. They didn't have it professionally photographed, right? It's not the level of exposure and level of presentation that you'd expect from Bring a Trailer or Barrett Jackson or any professional seller. So you're thinking, man, we're going to scoop this. Because we're not getting the answers that people want. Well, in that scenario, I think because the market's so crazy, people only look at a number on the odometer and they don't want to know whether it's real or not. Because there's so much profit to be had in this industry by reselling that, that people don't want the answers to those questions. Yeah. They just say, oh, well, I've got a 700-mile car. But anyway, the car sold for $401,000.
Holy, that's more than a turbo.
That's more than a turbo.
Oh. Now,
there is an adjustment for miles, but the car had some dings and scratches. So even if it was original paint, it might not be after it was like restored to a perfect 700 mile specification. But looking at the 964 C4 94 market, the highest sale I could find in history was $330,000, and that seemed to be an outlier because that was a heavily modified car. People say mods don't add value. Well, every now and then the right ones do. The second highest one, if we take like the one outlier out of the box and whisker plot, the second highest was $250,000. So if anybody thought they were getting a deal because this car was not super well presented at a Kiko Auctions that sells everything from farm equipment to low mile Porsches,
barrels full of gravel,
didn't happen. And I reached out to a number of serious Porsche collectors that like buying low mile stuff, and their bids were all much lower than that.
That's nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. So
has it ever come back on the market? Do you know?
You know, that's a great question. I have not seen it, but I also haven't Googled the VIN recently. Hmm. I have a feeling it went into a private collection of some sort with that much money being paid. But long and short of it is you either have the effect of a car that's that special, everybody finds out about it, or a car that's not special, people assume they're getting a deal because it's an estate auction. I've seen that over and over again with like automobilia and tools and lifts and like the gas pumps, you know, the old Sunoco, whatever gas pumps, Hess, stuff.
Yeah.
There was an auction a couple years ago that had a bunch of lifts, and our friend Austin went because he was going to try to pick up some equipment for his business, and the lifts went for more than you could buy one
new. And
why? Because That's it's an insane. Estate auction. We're getting a deal. It's here. Oh yeah, I'm getting a deal. We're going to buy all this stuff from an estate auction.
Ah, wild.
It's crazy. It's crazy. I was at a local estate sale recently at this like super, kind of like MCM house that was, it was interesting. Anyway, they had a BMW M3. That's why I went.
Okay. Nice.
And they had furniture, which is why I went because my wife wanted to look. But anyway, I'm like looking
at it. Who
asked
you to go first?
I like estate sales. Okay. I blame it on the wife, but $15,000 they're asking. I was like, ooh, E46 M3, $15,000. I like it. 250,000 miles.
Whoa.
And it was an SMG.
No, pass. I was like, hard pass.
How about five?
Good gravy.
So I asked the estate sale manager, I'm like, what really buys this thing? He's like, well, you know, offers start at 11 grand. Like, don't offer less than that. It's like, okay, I won't.
Yeah.
Bye.
Who is offering insanity?
Yeah. So there's a weird vortex around estate and repo auctions where people just, I don't know. It's almost a brilliant strategy of like, let's post bad pictures and say it's an estate sale. And
I wonder if it just like, it's obvious. It, the thing you mentioned about like, oh, it's an estate sale, I must be getting a deal. I wonder if there's some component of, oh, they didn't take good photos, this is probably better than it is in the photos. Like people making up these stories, sure, to be like, I'm going to get a deal, I'm going to go on, you know, if it was an armoire, they'd be going on Antiques Roadshow. You know, if this, I'm going to post this on the forums or on Bring a Trailer and either make a killing or get to brag about it. That's crazy.
Yeah. So back to the BMW Z8.
Oh, yes.
Let me give you the details. It was a 2000 or 2001.
Okay.
40,000 miles.
Okay.
It was a Euro car.
Did those go for more or less? Does it matter?
I was struggling to find out. Okay. There's a lot of opinions on why they're better, but generally Euro cars, until they're old enough, don't go for more. They go for less than US cars.
Are there
cars.
Huge differences with the Z8s?
It didn't seem like it, other than the rear taillights and a few other nuanced things. They have the red and amber rear taillights as opposed to all red, just like the Corvette C5.
Yes.
Silver on black, which is, in my opinion, the least desirable color combination, most common. It's definitely the least desirable for me, but it is a single owner car. So, well, he was married, but it was one owner since new. So that person imported it, full service records, hadn't had the performance package installed, but had all the accessories and stuff. So I'd looked at similar high mile cars and figured this was like a 140K car tops. But I wanted to be in it for less because it's not the color I wanted.
Yeah.
So it ended up selling for 129 grand plus 7% buyer's premium. Okay. So basically $138,000. So like not bad.
Yeah.
Of all the ones I've seen, I felt like this was the one that was maybe kind of a deal. It wasn't a, I stole this because it was an estate auction. Nobody's heard of it.
Yeah.
Somebody was in there that knew what Z8s were worth, but it actually didn't go for too much money. Like that was the right money for that car.
Are you feeling like you missed out?
No, because it's silver black. If it was a color I wanted, I would feel like I missed out. Okay. I went to 125.5 was my high bid.
Okay.
And I thought about bidding again, and I just said, no, I don't think it is. Because, you know, when I apply the difference between, okay, if I buy a 15,000-mile one, if I buy one with red interior, like, you know, you do all those things of you subtract 5% for it being Euro, you subtract 10% for it being black interior, subtract 10% for the miles, and all of a sudden you're up at, there was a 16,000-mile silver on red one that sold on Bring a Trailer, U.S. car, a couple weeks ago for 163K. So at 140 for 40,000-mile silver black, that's not a savings over that silver red one.
Yeah, and it's interesting that when you get to that level of car, you know, because I saw some similar stuff with GT3s, like there was the gray one that had a lot of questions about it listed for like 95 with 87,000 miles. And then you compare that to what then I paid for the white car, and it's like, we are entirely different worlds.
Absolutely.
For not, when you think in the big picture, price difference, not a huge amount of money.
Absolutely. So all that said, I guess this doesn't disprove my point. I just, this one was close enough to a deal to seem like a deal, but I've never seen anyone score anything at an estate auction. So be very careful. Do your homework before you go into these things. Don't assume you got a deal. But if you have gotten some great deals or seen some way outliers on the other side, we'd love to hear your stories about those in the comments. So if you picked up something where everybody was sleeping at an estate sale, definitely interested to hear about that. Like a promoted estate sale, not
Well, and I think that's the difference, because I'm thinking, like, if it's like just signs on the side of the road, like, nobody's going to know what's there. You could get a deal. But if it's online at Kiko, that's going to get out somewhere, just like the storage auction where somebody had accidentally
auction.
Yeah, that's probably
that's
better.
Our rules for the game here. Yeah. But even that M3, that wasn't an estate auction. That was a locally promoted estate sale.
They were just smoking something.
Absolutely. All right, let's go to, I don't know if this falls under Shrewd Negotiator, but we're going to talk about a kit car, because it's been a while since we made fun of kit cars for sale on Marketplace that said they were almost done, just needed brake pads or a battery or whatever. I even issued a challenge for people to find me one that was for sale that was actually completed.
Don't we see too, like, needs a fuel filter? That's it. It'll be fine.
That's
and I'm like,
it.
How often
yeah.
do you need to, or a fuel pump? Sorry, a fuel pump. How often do those go out?
Fuel pump and a battery. I found a Factory 5 GTM roller, quote unquote, on Marketplace the other day. And it's sad when the term roller is being used generously.
Can it be used generously?
It was in this case.
What?
So in the description, they said, quote, all parts included.
Okay.
But no motor or transmission.
I mean, that's significant, but roller.
That's a roller.
Okay.
Right. But don't say all parts are included. Quote, needs new body, which I have.
What is left? A fuel pump?
He also said the kit alone sells for $25,000.
Okay.
Now this GTM was asking $27,000, and after looking at the pictures, it looked to be slightly less than a kit. And I went on Factory 5's website to verify. Yes, you could have bought a kit for $25,000. They don't have them in stock anymore. They no longer produce them. But the only thing separating a kit that you would buy from Factory 5 and this one was this guy had obtained axles and some of the suspension pieces and brakes, because that's not included. But I feel like that's kind of the low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
But he also had, like, had less than a kit in other areas. Like, if I could buy a new one for $25,000, why would I buy one that you've then, like, hacked up the body and needs more work than one that you just get out of the box?
Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. From Factory 5's website, the GTM kit gives you everything you need to build your car except for running gear parts taken from a 97 to 04 Chevrolet C5 Corvette and a transaxle, which they often use a Porsche transaxle. Yeah. So, and in this description, he also said it used to be a running driving car featured on Top Gear. And he had pictures of it there. So he's literally gone backwards. He took a running driving car and then turned it into a kit that didn't have a motor or trans and needed the body installed and needs a new body, even though that's basically what the kit is the body.
God,
how do you go backwards that far? And that brings me to a question.
Okay.
Some listener had a great suggestion. They took your hot, crazy matrix from last week.
Yes, yes.
And they said we should make that a permanent thing, like the Top Gear board, and say, like, the cool wall, where do cars fit on the hot, crazy matrix? So, kit cars.
Just immediate no-go, no matter, or the danger zone. Like, they're never in the good parts. You're always, because they never work, Doug. They're always in the, like, wow, you're really reaching here. You've made a bad choice.
What about a finished Super Performance Cobra?
Yeah, but you're not like...
I feel like that's the fun zone. It's guilt-free. You're not paying $1 million or $2 million for a real Cobra. You get all the fun.
So don't you buy that finished, though?
Yes.
Okay, so maybe that's the thing. If it's bought finished, you're golden. Because ones that you don't buy finished, you need to rely on somebody to actually complete, and they're not going to. Just like any project car never gets finished.
And I think anyone on Marketplace that's half done, no go zone.
Yeah, no go, absolutely.
This
Get
one's in the
here.
No go zone.
Yes.
100%.
Sorry, bro.
Especially for $27,000.
Gosh. Well, they don't make it anymore, Doug. It's worth more. The Sheffield brand was recently revived by Jake Turkbus, an owner of an original Sheffield all-sport diver he received from his parents in 1970 when he was just 11, beginning his love of watches. As an adult, Jay used his extensive expertise in product development and marketing to revive the brand that started it all. He set out to develop watches with a high level of quality and specification at a value price. His first effort, and a successful one, on July of 2023, was the debut of the Sheffield All-Sport Diver 1. It had the kind of build and movement that much more expensive watches use, and his debut price of $108 was equivalent to the $13 his parents paid in 1970. Since that debut, Sheffield has expanded to a wider range of automatics and chronos, many designed around vintage Sheffield dials of the 60s. The Sheffield well of clever and unique design remains his inspiration, as well as maintaining the goal of high quality, very affordable range of automatic and quartz watches. Sheffield watches, value on merit, not just price. I love mine, so get yours at sheffieldwatches.com and be sure to mention you found them on Switchcast. Turns out that if you own a Hyundai Ioniq 5, you can't change your own brakes. That's not wild, Doug?
I mean, I can't imagine any scenario in which I would own a Hyundai Ioniq 5.
That's true. So, you know, we've talked a lot
about
how...
What's the difference between Ioniq and iconic?
Well, I don't know if any Hyundai's been iconic, so...
Yeah, there you go.
All right, so... there's a whole lot of stuff surrounding this. The Drive has a great article that we'll get into a little bit on why apparently you cannot change your own brakes if you have a Hyundai Ioniq 5. But Doug, do you know what right to repair is?
I do. And I've been following that quite a bit in the eventuality of doing a podcast episode about this, because there's been a lot of debate at the congressional level on whether or not this should be a law. And I'm not sure that I'm not sure which side I come down on that.
Oh,
honestly,
really?
Honestly, I'm not sure, because on the one side I go, well, it is capitalism. And if the manufacturer says we're making these cars and we don't want other people working on them, it's their product. They can do that. On the other side, I have owned an independent repair shop and I support independent repair shops, and I don't like going to the dealers, and I don't necessarily believe in monopolies either. So
he's torn.
I'm interested to hear you help me with this dilemma.
Okay. So for those of you listening or watching, right to repair is really, it is what it says on the tin. It is a legal right for owners of devices and equipment to freely modify and repair products such as automobiles, electronics, and farm equipment. We don't have time to get into it, but John Deere has been in the news a lot over the past decade or so for practices that are looked upon poorly by those advocates of right to repair. They've done a lot of locking down of systems and maintenance behind computer software that makes it so you can't fix your tractor. And that's kind of what has happened here. So, like I said, the Drive has a great article on it that kind of walks through how we got to the point where someone was able to post on Reddit that the Hyundai Ioniq 5 won't let you change your own brakes.
Okay, so why won't it let you? I can change brake pads. Is there something, what is computer related that doesn't allow you to change brake pads?
Everything. So, a lot of modern cars have electronic parking brakes.
Yes.
And you can't just, you know, move the handle down to disengage it. You have to press a button for it to disengage.
Yes.
There is some component of this car that has the electric parking brake engaged, like, at all times if the car isn't running, I guess. I don't actually know the full details on why that is, but essentially, you have to disengage that parking brake in order to change the brake pads so that you can spread the calipers enough to, like, actually, sure, you know, move the pads around, take them out. In order to send this command to the brakes in the rear, you need some OBD2 device that can, like, talk to the car and send the commands it needs. Sounds easy. AutoZone has a bunch of code readers and stuff. We can just do something, get one of those. None of that works. You need a specific device that is made to communicate with a Hyundai or meets this J2531 protocol or application for this communication. These devices are thousands of dollars.
I mean, Ferrari's been doing this stuff for like 25 years.
Sure. So you've got independents that need to save up the dough to buy the computer that talks to the cars. Like, that's kind of sort of normal.
And Ferrari often won't sell them to them anyway. So then they have to buy, like, jailbreak versions yes. of it, pirated Ferrari computers.
These tools are publicly available, so at least it's not like the Ferrari situation where you could, if you had, I think it's like $6,000 for the Hyundai GDS system that dealers can buy and mechanics can buy.
The gosh darn system? It stands for?
No idea what it stands for. Even if you had the tools and even if you really wanted to shell out that kind of dough to change your own brake pads, you still can't use or log into this system because you need a security credential from the NASTF. I've not written down, I don't remember what the NASTF stands for, but it is a governing body that deals with the lock coding, car credential management, and a lot of the cybersecurity related stuff with cars. There's a lot of computers in cars now, Doug, and there's lots of data in these cars. So if Joe Schmo Mechanic gets access to your car's system, they can tell where you've been, how fast you normally drive, what are your common routes to get places, et cetera, to either, I guess they could potentially track you and your movements to know when you're not home or try to sell you something, I guess.
I hate everything about this.
It's just a software
everything
application.
Everything about this.
So
this is why I just don't own newer cars. The yes. newest car I own is a 2015, and it drives me nuts that it cost me $400 to replace a dang fuel injector.
Yes.
But it got done in the shop behind my building.
And
so
you just popped one in, and then it was good. So I think, I am glad that there is some regulatory or governing or overarching body or that helps the industry, ideally helps, we'll just leave it at that, be more secure. I don't want people to be able to get the locking code for my car so that they can unlock it in the parking lot and steal it or steal my belongings or whatever, just because they can buy some, $1,000 device that can read that information.
But
that's good.
Okay, but that what...
That part is good.
Well, that wasn't a problem in the past. Other manufacturers haven't had that problem.
Well, this is a problem we've created because cars need to, Porsche needs to know when you're coming up to a tunnel, I guess, so that they can put down the windows and open a valve in your exhaust. And cars need to read speed signs because we can't read them with our own eyeballs.
Wait a minute. So let me get this straight. The same manufacturer. Mm-hmm. So I'm talking out both sides of my mouth in one sense, right? Like, okay, old cars you could very easily steal because you can hotwire them.
Yes.
But then newer cars, most manufacturers you can't steal because you can't reprogram keys or whatever. Like, it's not a thing, but it has been a thing for Kias and Hyundais. They've been in the news a lot. Like, some insurance companies wouldn't even insure them because they're so easy to steal. Same thing with Mopar products. You're telling me the same company that insurance companies won't insure because it's so easy for thieves to plug in, reprogram a key or program a key, steal them. You can tell I'm not a thief because I'm
like, how does this work?
Right. Whatever. It takes them like 2 minutes to program a key and steal your Hyundai. The same one that is so accessible for thieves isn't allowing customers to work on their brake pads. That same company is on both sides of this.
I don't actually think this is Hyundai's fault, maybe. I don't think they aren't necessarily saying you can't do this thing. You can read the article on the drive about this. There is a response from Hyundai where they say some things I'm going to touch on in a minute that I think hints at a little bit of malicious compliance. You just so happen to need access to a system that also has access to all of this other highly sensitive data and like security privacy data that you don't want everybody else having access to. So because you need access to the car's computer to tell it to disengage the parking brake, you also need access by virtue of that to everything else.
So is this solving the problem of thieves being able to steal Hyundais so easily?
Well, I actually don't know if Ioniq 5s are like easily sellable.
Solve that problem.
I hope so. I haven't seen reports of Ioniq 5s being stolen.
Okay. So what's being done about it?
So
do we trust the government to fix this?
I don't.
Is this what the government is actually for? Is to stop companies from being too monopolized?
Well, I think you could say that if a company wants to have poor practices with the data of their customers in the cars, so what I hate about the topic we're discussing is that we are talking about a car and I'm only talking about the data that is in the car. because cars are now pieces of software that gobble up in data and generate data and have access to these things for, or they need to do this for your lane keep assist, for your reading of stop signs, for your navigation, for your auto-ish pilot stuff.
For your tunnel mode.
For your tunnel mode. We have turned cars into computer programs instead of that just happen to function as a car. So there's a lot of stuff that we've caused difficulty in because of this. And this just happens to be one of them. Like, why did we need an electric parking brake? The lever worked fine. Why did we need to create this problem? I don't get it. So I think to an extent, it's good that there is some level of involvement from a body that says we need to be secure. So that's fine.
The parking brake lever gave too much autonomy to the driver who could pull it in the middle of an intersection to slide through it. Whereas can't the electronic parking brake does not allow you to execute such shenanigans.
So, like I mentioned in the Drive article, Hyundai did respond to, they had reached out to them to ask for comment, and Hyundai said that they're committed to supporting both their dealer network and independent repair facilities with safe, secure, and accessible service solutions. The official repair procedure requires placing the rear calipers in service mode using our GDS or the J2534 application. This ensures proper functionality and customer safety. Where I think this is malicious compliance is they say, well, this is publicly available, but it is prohibitively expensive, and you need the certification that we don't even tell you that you need in order to even log in and use the system. So, like, yes, it is available, but not just to the person at home. And some could argue that this is a bit of a slippery slope, even though maybe Hyundai isn't necessarily behind the reason this is happening. What if suddenly your car can detect what air filter you put in it, and it's not a certified part by the manufacturer? You could put your car into limp mode. It could do all, like, there's a bit of a bleak future potential in a lot of this stuff that makes me pretty uncomfortable and makes me want to keep just driving old cars. There are states that have passed right-to-repair laws to work against some of this stuff. And now this Hyundai situation is a bit doom and gloom and a bit significant, but I've even noticed with my fiance's Acura, the maintenance schedule is not in the owner's manual. I do this thing where I'd like to have a maintenance schedule for all of my cars so that I change the oil and the transmission fluid and the brake fluid, like when it needs to be changed for the longevity of the vehicle. Acura doesn't let you do that, and Acura dealers, from what I've read, will refuse to service the car unless their internal computer maintenance system says it's time for service. They don't even tell you the mileage. It just says there's an oil life that has a percentage.
Based on the mileage.
I'm guessing, or like time,
Yeah, mileage or time. It's not wild, like, actually, correct me if I'm wrong, it's not actually measuring like the viscosity of the oil or how effective it's, you know, the color of it. Maybe it is measuring the color. I don't know.
So there, it even goes to things as small as that. Like, I am now beholden to a dealer to service this car because it has a warranty and they need to serve this whole business. And it's like, well, I can't actually know when this needs done. I just need to trust that what the manufacturer says is correct. And
maybe it's because they don't trust their own mechanics.
It could be that. Yeah, they don't even know what to do. So, like I said, some states have passed some right-to-repair laws. What I think is fascinating is that Massachusetts passed these laws back in 2017, and it has caused a lot of issues. 2012, I'm sorry.
That's a long time ago.
Yes, they're very forward-thinking. And this has caused a lot of problems for manufacturers that need to somehow have an open-source way to access this information. And it got to the point where that open source system or that third party system doesn't exist. So Subarus, in an article from The Wired, actually will disable a lot of features of your car if you live in Massachusetts. If you live in Rhode Island or anywhere around, features are there. And it's stuff like oil service reminders. And there are some more significant things I'm forgetting at the moment. But it's like you lose features of your car if your home address is in Massachusetts.
No remote engine start. That's disabled.
Yeah.
For New England, that's not a good, no emergency assistance, no tire pressure warnings.
It's kind of crazy. And like none of it is like maybe super essential, but it's like you purchased a car with these features.
Wow. Wow.
So the fight continues because the Repair Act was introduced this year in the U.S. Congress and is currently undergoing reviews and investigations by various committees. Government doesn't move quickly. We know this.
Well, this thing started when Biden was president, which was at least like 2 years ago.
Yes. Like things have been
so long.
percolating for a while.
I've been reading about this for years in terms of it working its way through Congress.
Yes. So essentially, I don't have all the details of the act, but it would solidify right to repair for, you know, automobiles, electronics, farm equipment, et cetera, in the way that Massachusetts similarly has. So proponents of this, such as the Car Coalition, you can go to their website to learn more about their purpose and why they think this is important. You know, it enables consumer choice and access, fair competition, cybersecurity and safety precautions or protections, and safety and compliance stuff. You know, I am very for right to repair. I feel like I have purchased a thing and I should be able to ensure the thing still works even after the manufacturer doesn't want to support it anymore. Because what I worry about is all of these vehicles with all these computer systems. If we get to the point where the manufacturer doesn't want to support them or it doesn't make financial sense, they are dead. And then people who have invested all of this money no longer have a potentially working thing, and it creates
that's
more waste.
The point, though.
And that's why I...
Planned obsolescence.
Yes, exactly. You know, and so I want, you know, I like to drive, you know, old cars because I like them for various reasons, not just because they can be fixed. Why should a company not making parts or not supporting a software application anymore make it so I can't still drive this car? Now, there are opponents of this, of course. Surprisingly, NADA has a like little letter on their website saying why they don't support this.
Well, obviously, NADA is new vehicle dealers. They are only concerned about new vehicle dealers'
yes.
profit. New vehicle dealers also lobby against the like Rivian and Tesla and all of that direct sales to consumer. And they lobby against anything that's good for the consumer. Don't get me started on that.
So I think the fact that
don't
they support
get me started
this
on it
is enough to say that maybe it's good for the common man. So they allege that the info necessary to repair vehicles is already available. They say the proposed legislation is not about repair and is instead designed to provide third parties access to consumer data and enable auto parts manufacturers to reverse engineer parts.
No, if they didn't store consumer data in our cars and just
yes.
made them cars, then it wouldn't be a problem if they could access them. Our cars
yes.
should be cars, not...
They also allege it's going to create some massive regulatory framework and paperwork that's going to cost $100
yes,
million annually. Pulled that
is.
Out of their bum. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, it is. It is. But because you're storing consumer data on a car.
And it doesn't need to be like, I know this is a purely human created problem because we thought we needed all these cool features to tell us when we should stay in between the lines in a lane. Or know what the speed limit is on
so
the dash of
our car. So this is a symptom,
car.
Not the root. The root of the problem is that cars are computers
yes.
that are storing our data.
1,000%. The fact that I first was exposed to right to repair in terms of the electronics industry, and there's a lot of, in the effort to make devices and components more efficient and smaller, it means you can't repair them as easily. You know, this phones, I don't know, hopefully y'all remember, they used to have a battery that you could take out. And replace. There used to be an SD card that you could put into this. And
yep.
in making everything smaller, you can't do that. It's very hard to repair an iPhone or a Pixel or whatever. And, you know, that's where I first was like, why is my agency being taken away from me for the sake of like making it a little thinner? And now it's come to cars because cars are just technology, like software, data, computer technology, more so than just a piece of transportation.
Okay, well, that brings us to the props and flops brought to you by Switch Cars. I feel depressed. Thank you, Tyler. That's
no
what
problem.
Happens when I let him lead a segment. Switch Cars is the enthusiast dealership where we buy, sell, and cars that we like ourselves that are probably not new enough to be collecting data on you. Most of them have manual transmissions. Some of them, unfortunately, have electronic parking brakes. We have an independent service shop that services these cars prior to sale. Yep. And can service them after sale. All the wonderful things about automotive ownership that is real. Check out our handpicked inventory at switchcars.com and mention Switchcast for special pricing when available. Our pick of the week this week is a 2005 Bentley Continental GT. Luxury for less. Baller on a budget. Well, a very large maintenance budget, but a small initial purchase budget. Somebody else spent the money on the depreciation the first 20 years of maintenance, so you only have to pay for the next 20 years of maintenance.
I wonder when those lines cross. Depreciation. Like, when do you spend the amount that it had depreciated for somebody in maintenance?
After like 3 years. It's a Bentley. Amazing. Come on. But at least you can access their software for the most part. Anyway, it's cool. Burgundy with tan and burgundy interior, 44,000 miles, nice price point, and serviced in preparation for sale. Speaking of Volkswagen Bentley VAG product, Volkswagen Auto Group. Our flop of the week, the old Bugatti factory had, I guess, an impromptu party. This is via Car Vintage. Halloween night, thousands of people entered the former Bugatti factory and organized an illegal rave with loud music, food trucks, bonfires, broken glass, vandalized walls, graffiti, etc., filled what was once one of the most important symbols of Italian automotive engineering in the place where, of course, the Bugatti EB110 was born. So,
isn't it abandoned though?
Yes, but it, like, they made it worse. Like, just complete disrespect for that facility.
Ugh.
I don't like it. I don't like it. You shouldn't destroy things just because they're abandoned. Yeah. Created a mess for somebody else. I mean, it's like friggin' the Woodstock all over again, but not organized. Not like they actually cleaned up after themselves.
Just left.
Yeah. Anyway, our prop of the week is a 2008 Lamborghini Gallardo Superleggera for sale with 87,000 miles on it.
Whoa.
Not only is a Superleggera probably my favorite Gallardo, you know, lightweight, lots of carbon fiber, more simple version of the Gallardo, and probably the later rear-wheel drive cars are. Wait, is a Superleggera rear-wheel drive? I think it is. I'm questioning myself there. But anyway, 87,000 miles. Somebody had a lot of fun with that car and enjoyed it fully. In all the posts that we see everywhere about low miles, no miles, there's even a Facebook page dedicated to it. Look at how much I didn't enjoy this car. We love seeing it when somebody actually put the miles on, and I'm sure they have a bajillion stories behind that. So probably the highest mileage Superleggera in existence. Tyler, tell me, did I get it wrong or right?
Not all of them are rear-wheel drive. But some of them,
the first gen ones,
first gen,
it wasn't either or.
Oh, I actually don't know.
Okay.
I didn't have enough time.
Well, somebody can correct us. Something I should have known, but just take my car guy card away because I didn't know everything about every car, but I like those. I think they're fun. And somebody had a lot of fun putting that many miles on it. Thank you for joining us for Switchcast with Doug Tabbitt and Tyler Sanders, produced by Ethan Huffnagel. Switchcast is an automotive entertainment and opinion show, and nothing we say should be taken very seriously. We do not give tax, investment, legal, emotional, or professional advice, and the only licenses we hold are driver's licenses. The opinions expressed on this show are exclusively held by the people pontificating at that moment and do not reflect the values of our producers or sponsors. Our theme music is provided by Emily and Ivory. You can stream their full album on Spotify or SoundCloud. If you like this show, you can stream it in its entirety on your favorite audio podcast platform. Check out switchcast.live for more info.